Hey there, folks. You're listening to Inside the Desert Oasis Room, episode number 49. This episode is sponsored by Tanduay Rum. Established in the Philippines in 1854, Tanduay is the world's largest rum producer and winner of over 170 international medals in the past four decades, including Brand of the Year in London's World Branding Awards Rum category from 2015 to 2017 and Rum Brand Champion of the World by thespiritsbusiness.com in 2015. As sponsor of the Inside the Desert Oasis Room podcast and the toast to Master Ninja Ray Buen at the legendary Tiki Tea in Los Angeles, California, Tanduay Rum is the perfect companion to celebrate all things tiki. For more information, check out their webpage at tanduayus.com or follow them on Facebook or Instagram at tanduayusa. This podcast is also sponsored in part by the Royal Hawaiian. Founded in Laguna Beach, California in 1947, the Royal Hawaiian is South Orange County's premier tropical drink and dining destination. Come try their signature cocktail, the Lapu Lapu, a delicious combination of tropical fruit juices with a generous float of dark spirits, or other island-inspired favorites like ahi tuna poke or the dynamite crab-crusted mahi mahi. Enjoy their delicious brunch or drop in for happy hour from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. daily for drink specials and more. To make a reservation, visit RoyalHawaiianLB.com. On this episode, we chat with John Mulder from Ikum Bukum. John is an Army veteran of over three decades of service who went to art school on the GI Bill to start a new life as an artist. You probably know him best for tiki mugs he's produced for events like Tiki Caliente, Taboo, Mod Palm Springs, Tiki Oasis, Hukilau, and more. Today we hear how he got his start making tiki mugs for a living. As always, I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did bringing it to you, and if you did, I'd like to invite you to help us keep this show on the air. As you know, this podcast does not survive without the help of our sponsors or our listeners. So if you'd like to help, stop by DesertOasisRoom.com and click on the donate button. Every donation, no matter the size, helps keep this podcast coming to you every week. Alrighty then, here he is, the one and only John Mulder. John Mulder.
Hey, what's going on? Hey, Adrian.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing awesome, man. Just out here making tikis. That's the way it goes.
It never stops, does it?
Oh my gosh. It's just a projected deal where you just have to constantly be moving forward, and everybody's projects are immediate. So
of course,
we're currently working on Texas Tiki Week, which happens the week of September 11th through the 17th. Mm-hmm. And we're making the Bootlegger, which is a Palm Springs bar. It used to be in the old Don the Beachcombers
right.
on Canyon Drive.
I know so exactly we're making which one you're talking about.
They're super good. They do really kind of nice handcrafted cocktails down there. They make a great three dots and a dash. That's kind of my go-to one. But they're having their third anniversary on September 5th, so we're making their anniversary.
Oh, very cool.
So we're just trying to get those.
You went from I remember when you first came into the tiki world, and you ramped up pretty quickly.
It was kind of, it's that deal. We made our first mug probably 2011, and we had come in. I used to be a painter. I still paint. I love painting, and I had been a professional kind of like painting artist and a person that showed in galleries since the mid 90s or so. Mm-hmm. And so when I showed up on the tiki scene, we had been collecting tiki mugs since the mid 90s. You know, it's that classic deal where you're in the thrift store one day,
right?
And you look over, and mine was like a PMP peanut mug. That was my first tiki mug I ever bought.
That's
and,
a cool mug.
I still love those.
That's a classic. That's one of the classics, you know.
Love it. It's just a great starting point. So we were in a thrift store in Virginia, my wife Janet and I, and I picked it up and I'm spinning it around. It's a great little piece of sculpture and art. I'm into art and I'm into collecting things. And so, it was like a buck and I'm like, well, it's going home with me today. Yeah. And then like 3 days later, I found another, and then I had three, and then it was on,
Yeah.
So I've been collecting tiki mugs for years. And so I was painting. That was my big thing. And when you make art, you can have a lot of irons in the fire, and not all of them get hot at the same time.
What kind of stuff were you painting?
I was doing robots at the time. I was okay. Big into vintage robots. So I was doing a lot of vintage robots in the late 90s. But I was painting, I was making jewelry, I was sculpting and making like paper mache stuff. And not all my irons were getting hot. You know, I was doing little shows everywhere. And, in 1998, I just decided that I was 32 or so at the time. And I was in the Army, and I just painted a big show for a local coffee shop that was doing art, kind of like, I think of them as secondary art places, like display places, restaurants, coffee houses, things like that, you know, when you're trying to break into the art scene. Mm-hmm. And I did a big robot show, big toy robot show, like vintage robots, and I sold every one of my paintings. It was a big thing.
Oh, how cool is that?
And it was great. And I was driving to work the next day, and I was looking at the back of my hands. I know 32 seems like super young, but I was looking at the back of my hands, and they were just looking old. And I thought to myself, I want to grow up and be an artist. I've always wanted to grow up and be an artist. That was kind of how I identify myself as an artist, you know. And so I went home that night, and I'm like, hey, Janet, I don't want to. I had 14 years in the Army at the time, and I'm like, I don't want to grow up and just be an Army guy. Oh, I want to chase my dream of being an artist, you know. And so
that didn't come until later. That I thought that was all something that you were, because you studied art in school, right?
I did, but I didn't go to college until I was 37 years old.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
No, I went back through on the GI Bill, so through my Army days.
Okay.
And so I told Jenna, I'm like, hey, I really want to make the best at trying to make it as an artist, you know. And she's like, well, just do it, you only get one life, you know. So I finished out my Army contract, got out at 14 years and 5 months, and Janet was a registered nurse at the time, and
14
I started
years, man. Wow.
It's one of those things, you know, people, I don't know, the military is a funny thing. It was great for me, and I ended up going back as a civil servant and still flying for the Army and earning my ultimate retirement. So it was a big influence in my life, you know. In and out of the military, I was around it for about 32 years. I was a mechanic and a flight engineer for Raytheon Aerospace, mm-hmm. and yeah, I did a bunch of that stuff. So it was an awesome influence in my life. It's a big part of my life, and I still, you know, it really shaped who I am and how I act, you know.
Yeah.
So it was great.
Yeah. But, so, I mean, like, that's probably where a lot of the discipline came from, too, for,
I think
you have these production deadlines to meet, and, mm-hmm. you know, like the artist mentality a lot of times is that, yeah, you know, I mean, like so, there's a deadline, but it's a floating deadline, right? But
it's funny because, like, I actually work better on a deadline. If you're like, hey, paint me something and make it amazing, it'll never show up. If you're like, paint me something and make it amazing and I have to have it by September 1st, it'll show up on September 1st. You know?
Oh, really?
Okay. Oh, yeah, totally. You know, a lot of my friends, Doug Horn's the same way. You know, there's just a lot of people that if you have a deadline, then I'm ready to rock and roll. So I always give myself deadlines in the artist business. I think a lot of failings of artists, you know, because there's a million amazing artists in the world. And, you know, what people are like, how does an artist become successful? And I'm like, you have to make art that's good. You have to make an art that people want, and you have to, you know, have discipline. On my art studio door right now, there's a sign that says art doesn't make itself. And, I look at it every day, you know, and that's because I have friends that are going down and taking their boat out in Destin and going out to Shell Island this weekend. And they're like, hey, come on out. Let's spend the whole day out on the water.
Right.
But I have to make, the sculpture. I have to finish the molds for a delivery of October, and I'm like, I just have to knuckle down because art doesn't make itself. So I'm not going out, unfortunately, this weekend on the boat. I'm gonna just go in the studio and make molds.
You're just doing this. You're just doing this full time now, too, right?
This is it. This is my only job. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have to be disciplined in that way. I mean, like, this is your income. So if you're not working, if you're out on the water, then you're not making any money.
That's right. Yeah. It isn't like any other job where if you don't show up, you know, things will still happen and you'll show up on the next week and everything will be normal. If you don't show up here, the place is, you know, there's just tumbleweeds rolling through the place and nothing happens. So you've got to go in there and do it.
Yeah, it's not much different with this podcast that I'm doing. Is that?
Oh, I'd imagine.
Man, if I am sitting idle, even if it's just for an hour, I feel like I'm losing productivity, right? So, and productivity means all kinds of stuff, right? It means that, you know, let me start by saying that, you know, like I've been super busy lately. The podcast has led me down this road where I'm doing all kinds of other media projects
awesome,
now.
And
which is great, but I was telling Stephanie the other night that I said, you know, God, I'm so busy doing all this other stuff now because of the podcast that it's almost like I don't have time to do the podcast anymore, but I can't forget to continue to do the podcast because that's the product, right?
Yeah.
And if I don't have a product to sell, I don't have anything to basically, like, you know, I bill my sponsors, right? So if I don't have a product for them, you know, to put their placements, I can't bill them, you know? And without those sponsors, right, I have no income. So all this other stuff that's happening, I have to still stay on top of the main thing, which is I got to make this product. And if I'm sitting idle, I feel like, okay, I should be editing right now, or I should be marketing right now, or I should be, you know, whatever it is. So
we had the same experience. It's the deal where you, people are like, well, you know, you do all the kind of event mugs and things like that. We've been fortunate enough. We were in the right place at the right time kind of to pick up the kind of the big event mugs and do, you know, Oasis, Huki Lao, Caliente, a couple of other things. And people are like, well, your mugs are selling for X amount, you know, on the secondary market. Why are you still doing all the event mugs? And I'm like, the reason our mugs are selling on the secondary market is partially because we do the event mugs. You get your notoriety from that. You know, that's our, that's kind of, you know, where some of our, you know, tiki mug, you know, notoriety comes from, is that we are involved on those things and it allows us to do these other secondary projects, and have kind of, you know, that kind of, you know, not, I don't want to say fame, but, you know, perceived, you know, kind of value, you know,
we are
a mug maker, and we get to, because we're, you know, we're one of the top five kind of like people that we do in our industry, or I think so, you know.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah,
you know,
totally.
That do the thing that we do, the kind of custom handcrafted higher end tiki mugs, and we get to do that because we are involved in these other things. And these other things, are, we get to do those because we are making those things. So it's one of those deals where you're like, it, you know, one hand shakes the other. So you have to continually do them. And, you know, the truth is that we work so hard making these mugs and doing all this stuff. And you get focused in on kind of the production of them and just like the day-to-day grind. And then you show up to like Tiki Oasis or the Huki Lao, and you know, you see the joy that people get by like running around. They come up, thank you, and it turns it in from like production into art again. All of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, people really love these things. And you don't see them for a couple of weeks or a month, and you're like, oh my gosh, they really
they're
really pretty.
It must be a great feeling.
it's very satisfying as an artist, for sure.
Yeah,
you know, to make art that people want, it's awesome.
Yeah,
I love it.
So I have this thing that I always find fascinating, that I see it in my life every day, and I see it in other people's lives as well. You know, there was a time when I was programming code for a living. You know, I came from the IT world, and and I was doing that for almost 2 decades, 17 years. And prior to that, you know, I was drawing custom homes, and I always have this thing that, like, you know, how did I get here, right? Like, one day I'm drawing custom homes for a living, and then fast forward a little bit, and I'm programming line code for a living, and then boom, I'm standing in a seafood city filming a commercial, you know? And it's like, how did I go from that to this? And you ever wonder about that? Like, you know, you were in the military, right? And What were you doing in the military? Were you a mechanic? I believe you did stuff with helicopters, right?
Yeah, I was a mechanic and a flight engineer on Chinook helicopters. So,
on Chinook helicopters, and then one day you get up and you're walking into a mug making studio and you're pouring tiki mugs. You know,
like yeah.
you ever think about that? Did you ever see yourself doing what you're doing today?
It's funny because like I always thought I'd grow up and be an artist, you know, and it doesn't accidentally happen. You know, you show up and you put the work in. You know, I say that I'm fortunate, and there was a bunch of lucky coincidences that kind of lined themselves up mm-hmm. to put me in the position that I'm in today. And did I see myself as an artist being a tiki mug maker? I thought I'd be a famous painter,
mm-hmm.
But the road led me down tiki mugs, and I probably haven't painted a painting in 3 years.
Oh, you're kidding me. I was just about to ask you if you're still painting because, and I'm curious, I'd like to see some of those paintings.
Oh, yeah.
Where, are they online?
Yeah, if you look up, my artist name, everybody had an artist name back in the day. It was cool. And so my artist name was Mulder142. So that's
right.
My last name was the number 142. So if you just Google 142 under Mulder142 under images, my old paintings will pop up.
Oh, I'll have to take a look at that. Well, now
I showed at pretty big galleries. I used to show it in Modern.
Okay.
All that kind of stuff.
I might have seen your work before then, because I used to go to Modern all the time. So you're just doing tiki mugs, though. Have you ever thought about doing a little bit more than just mugs and start doing paintings again, too?
When we're about to move from our Alabama studio to a new studio in Florida, and I want to set up a painting shop. I want to get back. Alabama's a funny place. It's very rural, and I've lived here for 7 years now. We moved out here to teach at the Army Flight School. I took an instructor job at the Army Flight School as a civilian to finish out my retirement time. And so I came out here. We had never really been out here that much before, and I was offered a job both in Virginia at the Army like mechanic school,
mm-hmm.
and one down in Alabama at the Army flight school. And I had already taught up in Virginia. That's where Janet and I first met. And so I was like, well, let's try something new. You know, variety is the spice of life. So we took the job in Alabama, and it's very rural down here. And it's been odd. You know, I've been trying to set up. I always belong to the local artist association. I surround myself with fellow artists. And there's just none of that here. I haven't been able to do it. So I'm looking forward to getting back into a painting group. When I lived in Oregon, you know, I had a Tuesday night painting group. I painted with, 20 people every Tuesday night and had a critique group and did all that stuff. I love painting.
How cool is that? I mean,
yeah,
that's more than just creating art. That's a whole social circle too, right? I mean,
you know, it's funny. Other artists will understand what I'm saying is, I always, in my whole life as an artist, I always have to act like I always feel like I have to pretend to be normal around normal people, and I can really just be myself around artists. Like my radio is just tuned a little different than everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to be around other artists because you don't have to like hold back or pretend to be, you know, Johnny Stiffshirt or whatever, you know, talk about Volvos and 401ks.
Right, right.
You know, so it's nice to have other artists that you can just like let your guard down and be normal, and they don't look at you like this guy's nuts,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I'm always looking for that kind of deal. And the other thing is with art, you get fired up by other artists. Not only do I go and look at art all the time. I love art. So it's my whole life, really.
You know, something that used to happen out here in Southern California a lot was, and I don't see it happen as much as it used to, is we used to organize these art jams, right?
Yeah.
And it would be maybe every couple of months, you know, somebody would say, hey, let's have an art jam at so-and-so's house, you know, or wherever they would do it. I've had some here before at my house, and whatever project you're working on, bring it on Sunday, you know, show up at noon. We'll work all day, and you know, we'll make drinks and we'll order
just
pizza
talk,
and all that kind of stuff. And it was fun, you know,
dude, I love
and
that stuff.
You'd have people like making lamps, or someone carving a tiki in the corner, and then another person or two painting, you know.
Yeah.
And it was fun being around that, you know. That it just reminded me when you say, like, you guys feed off of each other, right?
The
creativity flows, and people say, like, hey, how about this? Or how about, have you thought about trying that? You know, and, you know.
Well, even just with critique, when you make art, you know, you get married in it. You're invested in it because it's a thing that you've made. And so you stare at it and you're like, oh my gosh, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Right.
But somebody that's not invested in it can stand right next to you, somebody that you respect and value their opinion. And you're like, well, I think the color's a little heavy here, and if you brightened up here or added a, you know, a compositional element in this corner, it would balance it out better. And, you know, if you're an objective person, you'd be like, oh my gosh, you're totally right. You know?
Yeah. I get some of that with the podcast too. And people will say, hey, you know, I really enjoy your show, but, you know, maybe you should try. And then they'll make a suggestion. And it's, the show has grown because of that, you know, like I've implemented some of the things that people have tried. And, you know, in the beginning I was kind of like, nah, you know, but then I thought,
I'm in charge.
Let me give it a shot. Well, and, you know, but yeah, going back to the art jam stuff too, you know, one of the art jams that we were at the end of the day, I had made a couple of lamps, and some of them were pufferfish lamps. And Big Toe was like, hey, those are cool. He's like, man, that came out really good. And I was like, yeah, I said, I really like that painting you did too. I was trying to work out a barter, you know?
Yeah.
So you get that kind of stuff too. But yeah, they're lots of fun. You know, like sometimes I forget that you're out there in Alabama, you know, like as an artist in the tiki world, and I see you at all the events.
Yeah.
You know, you're, I just saw you a couple weeks ago. It was 2 weeks ago. It was just two weeks ago, right?
Oasis,
At Oasis, and we get to hang out for a little bit, and you know, you're obviously, you know, an active member in the tiki community, so you're one of us, right?
Sure.
So,
yeah.
And my world is all these tiki people, and I sometimes forget that, you know, because I see you pretty regularly, I forget that you live like 2,000 miles away, you know?
I'm tiki isolated.
And when people say like, hey, so where's his shop located? I want to have him do some mugs for me, and I'll tell him he's in Alabama. Yeah. They'll be like, Alabama?
What the heck?
It just doesn't match, you know?
Yeah. It's funny because when I first moved out here, it was 2010, and I immediately got onto Tiki Central, and I was like, where are all my Tiki friends, man? I got to see some home bars and get together, and where do we go to drink, and all that kind of stuff, and it was just crickets.
So there's no Tiki
response.
People there at all?
Well, you have Tiki Kaliki, Christy White lives up in Birmingham, and I think there are people, you know, spritzed around, but you know, even when people are like, you know, what do you do for a living kind of thing, and I'm like, I have a ceramics company, and if they want to pursue it more, I'll tell them we make tiki mugs. But if you're just like, we make tiki mugs, and they're like, what are tiki mugs, you know what I mean?
Now you don't do anything else outside of tiki mugs. It's all tiki.
No, not at all. It's all tiki all the time.
Because I know that like Monk Tiki, that before they got into tiki mugs, they were doing like bathroom accessories.
Totally. Yeah, Paul, the dad, has been in the tiki business
ceramics.
I guess they're in ceramics for 30 or 40 years. That's why when you obviously they're the benchmark of a lot of things in the tiki scene. You look at their glazing and all that stuff. Those people just have the years of experience it takes. You know, people are like, they're like, what are you going to do on this one? And I'm like, I saw something in a cartoon once, and I think I'm going to try it. You know, it's all experimental accident. We call them happy accidents in the art world. You know, I'll do all these things, and you'll open up the kiln, and you're like, well, that didn't work out, or it looks different than you thought, and you're like, how? But it's amazing. And you're like, how do I reproduce?
Right.
That?
Yeah.
So you know, Paul and his son Miles out at Monk Tiki, they just have the. You know, they're obviously super talented and nice people, but they've got the iterations, you know, they've got the experience under their belt.
Now, what are you making for yourself? I mean, like, I know that when you first started, there was stuff that you were doing generically as you can book them. But it just seems like you're so busy now that you're doing, mugs for everyone else. Are you still doing anything that's under just your own label?
I still try to pop out, you know, a mug occasionally. It's funny because in my sculpture studio, I've got about 7 sculpts up on the shelf that are ready for molding that are all my own designs. And I like traditional tiki. I'm a vintage mug collector, so I'm into that kind of like traditional tiki simplicity of design kind of thing. So that's what my mugs that I make for myself kind of lean towards. But you're right, we're just so busy with you know, all these other custom orders, which is awesome. There's worse things to happen.
Oh yeah, that's a good thing, man. I mean, that's I think, you know, a lot of the people in the community, especially the collectors, I think everyone's wanted to try their hand at making mugs, let alone make a living out of it. You know, it's such a niche thing, you know, and to be busy enough to make a living out of it, it's pretty damn cool.
It's the American dream, you know. Like, so in 2010, I was painting, I was doing a series of paintings called Scooter Gods. I ride Vespas and stuff like that, and restore Vespas. So I was kind of reimagining the iconography of the world's religions, you know, mm-hmm. Buddhism, all these things, and taking the same kind of icon art with all the symbology and reproducing those same kind of style paintings, but everybody riding their Vespas. And because I'd been, I was a big tiki geek and I had a huge collection of tiki mugs and tiki junk, and I was doing a lot of tiki gods on their scooters as well. So Ku, Kanaloa, you know, all those guys. And there's a magazine called Scoop Magazine, and they have an annual art issue, and I was the centerfold.
Oh, really?
Art issue, yeah.
Nice.
The guy, Paul Franks, he does the monkey stuff. He was on the cover. I was the centerfold. You know, it's still one of the highlights of my life, because I'm a huge scooter geek. I'm a big tiki geek. I'm a big art geek. So it's just the culmination of everything.
Of course, when you say centerfold, my first thought is a photo that's like buzzy, right? Where you're just down to your jocks buzzy, or something, you know? And you're like,
nah, it was a big coup.
Yeah,
riding his 1960s Vespa right on the beach with the volcano exploding in the background. It was a beautiful painting.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I know that you studied sculpture when you were in art school, right?
I did, yeah. When you go to school, it's funny because, you know, you have to – I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts, and everybody has to take your foundation classes, and then everybody has to take sculpture and all these things. And I was already a painter. I was 37 years old and, mm-hmm. you know, an established painter. So what do you learn when you go to college? Do you want to just have somebody that, you know, that is your same age that is teaching college to teach you something that you already know how to do, mm-hmm. and have an established style in? Or do you go into the studios that have, like, process? So I went into sculpture and just went nuts, because, like, it was everything. It was marble carving, it was stone casting, it was pouring bronze, you know, lost wax, resin sand casting, I did assemblage, I learned every type of welding. I'd taken welding and done welding before, but, you know, welding bronze and welding aluminum and all that stuff. So I also did a lot of printmaking, because, like, lithography,
right,
you know, all the intaglio, they're all process driven. You have to have the big presses and do all that stuff. And as a little artist, you know, we can do a little bit of that stuff, lino cut, linoleum block cutting, wood cutting, stuff like that. But, you know, you get into those situations where they just have the huge machines that do it all, and it's just process driven. So those are the things that I really kind of poured myself into in college. And I did really well in sculpture. I had, in the 90s, I was probably 20, 23, and my mom was an artist. She was going to go to college out at LA Art Center. And she and I just had to have a connective bond. I was in the military.
Right.
I used to sculpt head, hands, and feet out of Sculpty. And then I would send her the head, hands, and feet. It was probably 89, 90, 91, something like that. And I would send her the head, hands, and feet that I would sculpt for her. And then she would make the armatures and sew the clothing. And she would make Santa Claus dolls, and then she would sell them. It was just a way for me to make art with my mom.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I first kind of developed my sculpting, you know, kind of chops, was doing that. And it's funny, too, because, like, I noticed that my drawing skill, just my draftsman skills, immediately changed after I began sculpting. It was something that, connected mm-hmm. in my brain when you'd have to sculpt eyeballs and lips and noses. There was something with the actual trying to figure it out three-dimensionally in clay that made my drawings kind of more realized. You know, it was something that it connected inside my brain that made both elements better at that point.
Now, what was the so you said that you were doing hands and that kind of stuff, but
yeah,
when you really started getting into sculpture, what was the main subject?
Oh, it's funny because my professor was named Thomas Morandi, a very accomplished guy, probably the best professor I had through my education. But he was into the New York style of art. You had to represent man's inhumanity to man, and it didn't matter what it looked like as long as you had like an artist statement to support it. Right? Mm-hmm. So after I got through sculpture one, you know, you go into like sculpture two, and then you have to like come up with a concept, prove it with an artist statement, and then create it, right? And I made this huge tiki out of wax. You know, you do lost wax and pouring bronze. And I wanted to blow glass and have flame coming out of the top of it and have it. There's big lava fields in Oregon where mm-hmm. I went to college. And so I was going to get lava and put it on a big lava base and have this fully, realized coup, in the whole thing. Thomas Morandi was like, nope, that can't be done. That's not the art you make here. You got to uh-huh. make some kind of a convoluted New York art. And he never let me make tiki art the whole time I was there.
Wow. You know, okay, so I have a comment about that.
Yeah, me too.
I spoke with Bosco about a month mm-hmm. ago, and he's on a previous episode. And he talks about, he's great. He went to Art Center. And
oh, is that right? Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the greats did, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the tiki people did, you know. Crazy Al went to Art Center, and Kevin
right.
Murphy, he one of the owners of the Tonga Hut, he went to Art Center.
Coolest, nicest guy.
Yeah,
ever.
Super, super nice guy. So Bosco was saying when he was in art school, he couldn't do tiki art. Same thing, that the instructors were like, no tikis.
Yeah.
And it happened more than once. It was, a couple of projects where he said, yeah, so I couldn't do tiki for this project, so I did something else. And then there was, like a year later, different art instructor, different class, different everything, right? And when he was tasked with coming up with a concept for that particular project, the instructor said, no tiki. And what is the deal with that? I mean,
I think it's just the professor model. Like I said, I think the art school, the art center's a little different. They're more design based, and so but if you go to, I had friends that went to Yale for painting and all that stuff.
Yeah,
they're not even making paintings. They're just I always kid because we use plaster to make all our molds, and they'll be big chunks of plaster on the ground from
right.
messing up and stuff, and I'm like, this would sell for like $2,000 in New York if you could just come up with. And I swear, I look at all my friends that it's no joke. I mean, all you have to do is have a gallerist explain it in such a way that the art critic likes it.
Yeah,
in the art world, there's three levels to it. The art critic and the gallery owner are kind of the two top levels, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the buyers. The buyers are the people that buy into whatever their gallerist and art critic tell them. And then you have the artist. And the artist is just kind of the person that's working the assembly line. They're the bottom of the rung, because it's all about salesmanship and
right.
the emperor's new clothing, I always tease about.
Yeah.
Where, I know what art, it's like pornography. You know it when you see it,
Sure.
Art is the same way for me. If you see a piece of art and it's amazing, it's amazing to you. And you don't have to buy into the Rothko style of art to really appreciate and love art.
So
I'm not a believer in all that.
Going back to that piece of plaster that you said on the floor,
so great.
I look at that kind of stuff, and what I appreciate is this is not something that everybody else has. I say that a lot, you know, when it comes to collecting. A lot of these things that, you know, the mugs or whatever, it could also be in other things, you know, in other forms like baseball cards and things like that. You know, they might make 500 of a specific piece.
Sure.
I'm not interested in having one of 500. What I'm interested in is the one that you experimented with this glaze and it didn't come out the way that you wanted to. So that mug sat on the shelf because that was a tester. And everybody else has the one with the glaze that was intended. But tester, you know, especially the artist, looks at those things and says, yeah, that's a reject. And then they toss it out or they use it for, you know, they throw it in the garden or something, you know. And that's the stuff that interests me, because then I have this piece that no one else has and it's unique. You know, it has a story too, where I say like, yeah, you know, like this was supposed to be the blah, blah, blah. But like, for example, going back to Bosco, right? When I was at his place recording a podcast with him, he had one of his Marquesan skulls. And, you know, he told me, yeah, that was inspired by Tiki Diablo, because he's like, yeah, you know, Danny came out with this Marquesan skull. And I was like, oh my God, that's so creative. I need to do something like that. And so, inspired by, I should say, because, you know, I'm going to correct myself. Bosco's was not a Marquesan skull. It was a Rarotongan skull. It had the eyes of like a Tangaroa, but it was motivated by that Diablo's Marquesan skull. And it was glazed in this kind of like this cream color. And I said, oh, this is an interesting glaze. I've never seen this one before. And it was just sitting on his kitchen counter. And he said, yeah, he's like, that's the test glaze for the new Jeff Berry mug that I'm making. And I was trying to see, like, you know, how the color would come out. It's supposed to be like a flesh colored. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And he's like, yeah, he's like, you can have that one if you want. That's a reject. And I was like, awesome. So I took it home and I'm thinking, like, I've got something that no one else has, because it's a test glaze, right? It's not a production glaze. And, that's the kind of stuff that interests me, you know?
I have a big shelf over in my shipping and receiving area that's just all like defunct test glazes.
Oh,
and,
see, dude, I would salivate for that.
Yeah.
So you know what I'm getting at, right? You can't throw those out. You got to think of me. So.
This episode is sponsored in part by Steadfast Pomade. Steadfast Pomade is a strong-holding, medium-bodied, water-based styling product for men and women, which leaves your hair looking slick, neat, and shiny with a clean, fresh scent. Its unique formula allows you to easily restyle your hair throughout the day and washes out with ease. Steadfast Pomade is American-made and veteran-owned. Available in original and anchor hold, get yours today at steadfastpomade.com. Tame the waves and keep it steadfast. This episode is also sponsored by Tiki Tea. Founded in 1961, the Tiki Tea is a family-owned and operated tropical drink bar practicing the lost art of exotic cocktail mixing. Come try their house specialty, the Ray's Mistake, a delicious concoction of botanic liqueurs, passion fruit, gin, and rum for only $6 on Wednesdays until 9 p.m. The Tiki Tea is located at 4427 Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, California. For more information, check out their website, tiki-ti.com. The Tiki Tea, ground zero for tropical drinks.
So going back to this whole thing about, you know, instructors telling you, like, you know, no tiki art.
Yeah.
You know, like, when you look at art movements, it's all the stuff that is outside of the box, right? If you look at, like, what Warhol did or what Lichtenstein did, it was all the kind of stuff that people weren't doing that stuff. Like Keith Haring, people weren't doing that stuff as acceptable art. It was counter to what was acceptable, right? Counter to what everybody was expecting
guerrilla
to see.
Style stuff.
So it just kind of blows me away, because, you know, shouldn't they be encouraging that in art school? Shouldn't they be encouraging, like, people to think that way, you know?
I think that I'm really not sure. There's a kind of the old school of thought that, like, people that can't do teach, and the people that can't teach critique, kind of thing. So You know, I was going, when I went back to get my bachelor's of fine arts, I was on the GI Bill. So I had a full kind of scholarship all the way through art school and then into my master's degree of secondary education to teach high school art. That was kind of what I was going back to do, become a high school art teacher.
Oh, that's interesting.
I love teaching. I'm into teaching. It's the only place you can give advice and people are like, oh, that sounds like a pretty good idea. Yeah. So, by the time I'd finished my bachelor's degree, I'm like, you know, I don't want to be a teacher. I want to be an artist, you know. I just want to go out and make art that's interesting to me. They like the teachers, the professors, you know, really kind of killed that spirit in me because they just pushed the New York, I call it the New York style of art. They just pushed it so heavily because I think that that's what everybody wants to, all of them want to be in art in America where it's just right. A gigantic, you know, canvas with a blue thing in it. And they talk once again about man's man kind of deal. I don't get it. I'm like, I like narrative representational art. You know, I like to, you know, see it. I always talk about replay and replayability in video games. The best video games you can keep playing forever, right?
Right.
And the best art you can stare at over and over and over again, you know? So for me, I love the idea of narrative art. I like looking at you know, Shag is big into that. There's a story in those things, and you can pour your own emotions and, you know, connect emotionally with each one of those kind of stories because there's a story, and it isn't just a big blue dot that matches your couch. So that is what's interesting in art to me.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to talk about something fun.
Sure.
You know, art. Like not that our conversation isn't fun, but I want to talk about the monkey suits. So, you know, like all these different events that I see you at, every once in a while, all of a sudden a group of monkeys pop out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I suspect...
I think they call themselves Damn Dirty Apes.
I didn't know that there was a name for the group.
Oh. Well,
I suspect I know at least one of the guys, and perhaps yeah. It's the person I'm talking to right now.
You know, I think the thing that's fun about those kind of situations is, you know, we all go to these tiki events, and I've even seen them at, like, even just in bars. Like, we were out for, there's a place called Lalo in Houston.
Right.
Tiki bar out there. Super fun. The owners are great. The bartenders are wonderful. And they were having an anniversary, and we were out there just, like, hanging out and drinking, and Damn Dirty Ape showed up with a couple of... And, you know, they run through the place. People have fun with it. Right. It looks like they're having fun. There's one guy that just runs around with a banana and yells, "Oh, banana." And, which I'm assuming in gorilla means something.
Yeah.
And
I think
goes out. Then but I think the thing that's fun about it is not only is it fun for the members, but I think it's fun for the people that get to be part of it. You know what I mean?
Well, it certainly adds to the atmosphere of the event. Right.
Oh my gosh.
Have you ever? So I shouldn't say have you. Do you know if the monkeys have ever pissed anybody off with their shenanigans?
You know, obviously there are a lot of people imbibe rum. Some people are really frightened of people in masks or in gorillas. So I think it can be scary and intimidating when you get up in these little faces. But I think the group members are all, you know, they were all fun adults, and everybody knows their boundaries and tries to.
I love the thought of when people are making their list of what to make sure that they bring, you know, when you're packing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And whether
yeah,
that's checklist. A written list or that's a mental list, that the monkey suit is on the list.
there's nothing more heartbreaking than to find out you didn't pack your gorilla head.
Oh,
I know.
You pack the body, but you don't pack the head.
We try to bring in like new people, you know, and there's always people that want to join. And I always tell them, I'm like, you got to run as the chimp the first time. I want to make a pole that has like a coconut.
This is the chimp. That's the hazing, right?
That's the hazing, yeah. That's as deep a hazing as we get. I'm like, everybody runs as the chimp their first night.
Oh, that's hilarious. Now, you have a mug that has Gonsville on it. Is it a gorilla or is it a monkey?
It's
an ape
gorilla,
of some sort. It's a gorilla with a hat, and it says Gonsville on the front. And I'm fortunate enough to have one. I'm actually looking at it right now as I'm sitting here.
I love
Desert
that
Oasis
mug.
Room. I love that mug. Yeah. Was that the motivation? Was the
some of it. The Gonsville Goons were myself, Matt Reese, who goes by Reesnick, and MP, Michael Patron, is another mug maker up out of the Bay Area. I think he's living in Santa Cruz now. We used to hang it and vend at Oasis, and Matt had this idea that we're in a group, you know, we're kind of like nutty dudes, and we're going to call ourselves the Gonsville Goons. And so Matt used to run around in a gorilla suit. He has a full gorilla suit, and not just at events, but he like rides his bike in Ensenada with it. I mean,
That's hilarious.
It's been a thing his whole life. And then I don't know, probably Hooky Lau, 2008, 2006, something like that. There's a band called The Intoxicators, kind of an East Coast surf band, super great. We see them a lot kind of more out on the East Coast than you do on the West Coast. But they've got an alter ego band that's called The Disasternauts.
I was going to say, Disasternauts.
And, they're kind of surf punk, and they do a full different set. They come out in gorilla suits, and I'm like, so that, like, sparked my idea of we should just get a group of dudes and run around.
Now, I didn't know that the Disasternauts and the Intoxicators were the same band.
Is that right?
Yeah, well, I never knew that.
I don't know if that's true. I don't know. I don't want to out anybody. So Devo used to do the same thing. I grew up in punk rock and new wave. And so in the early days, like back in 79, 78, Devo would have a band that would come out called Dove, D-O-V-E, and open for them. And it was just them. They'd come out and do a few songs as Dove, and then they'd rock out as Devo.
I didn't know that either.
So that's a lot of fun. So that's where that was kind of born from. And
I hate to bring this up, but I feel like I need to because I'm curious about this too, and it all goes hand in hand with the events and stuff, and you guys traveling the country, and that is your old kitty Chewbacca. I miss Chewie.
Oh, Chewie, yeah, he was our traveling cat. He was a 12-year-old Persian that we'd have. And just an amazing cat, the coolest cat you ever had. And he traveled with us. He went everywhere with us. He'd sit at the booth when I was out.
Yeah. Chewie would be up in all the room parties with us and would be laying across the dashboard on a trek across the country.
Yeah.
And I had to bring up Chewie because I'm a cat person.
Me too.
I have a cat that's 20-plus years old right now.
Yeah.
And before that, I had a cat that lived to be 17. So I'm a cat person. I love Chewie. And I was saddened to hear when Chewie's time came to an end. Was Chewie ever scared of the monkey suit?
No, it's funny because
give a rat's ass, right?
Yeah, he's very mellow. He was a very mellow guy. It's funny though because we have a dog named Lou, and he's a little Chihuahua Yorkshire Terrier, like 7 pounds. Yeah. When you put on the gorilla mask,
I met Lou at the Las Caliente.
Dude, he's the best dog ever.
Yeah.
But when you put on the gorilla mask, your animal no longer recognizes you, but you still smell and sound the same. And so there's a lot of head tilting, like, I don't know what's going on right now kind of deal.
But do they still know that it's you if they recognize the smell and the sound?
I guess, you can see the question marks rolling around in their eyeballs, though, for sure.
There was a video of a dog that I guess like his favorite toy was a little Gumby doll. And his, I don't know if it was his master or owner that came in a full-size Gumby suit, and the dog went crazy, right?
Oh, yeah.
Dog jumped on him and stuff.
Can
you imagine? And, oh, my God, man, it was hilarious. It was cute, you know, and my thought was, can't he smell his owner? He would have to know that that's his owner, you know?
Oh, well, his brain just went on tilt, though, right?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Like, he stopped and looked at the costume, and he thought, you could see it in his face, like, oh, my God, is that really him?
My prayers have been answered. Finally.
Right.
Animals have the same kind of emotions we do, you know? So.
Yeah, they sure do.
So let me tell you my Tiki Mug origin story, and then I gotta go make mugs, man.
Okay.
So I'd done the centerfold for Scoop magazine, and a friend of mine was running an art show for the National Lambretta Jamboree. And they meet annually all over this deal. And a friend of mine was running the art show for it. And he's like, hey, we want you to design a tiki mug for it. You know, a tiki god riding riding a Lambretta. Yeah. And they're like, we'll have Monk Tiki produce it. You know, and I had already made tiki. I made my first tiki mug in like 2001 or something like that. So I'm like, absolutely. And I drew the turns, you know, you draw front, back, side to side and all that kind of stuff. And they had Monk Tiki produce them, and it turned out great. But when I was looking at it, I was like, yeah, you know, I'm like, I'm a sculptor. Why am I not doing this? I have 600 tiki mugs, you know, It just doesn't make any sense. And, you know, I just started making mugs. And the first year I just made a couple of mugs for myself. The second year I'd vended at like Caliente 3 or something with paintings. And the next year I showed up with a couple of tiki mugs that I had made. And then, Rory Schneider, who is the owner and promoter of, Tiki Caliente out there. I had a new event coming, like 2012, and he's like, why don't you make the mug for us for that little event? It was called Taboo. We made the mug.
Yeah, I have that mug too.
I love that mug. It's funny to look at it now, you know, because when you're looking at it, you're like, you know, as an artist, you're like, well, I would make different choices and did different things here. Right. But now I'm looking at it, I'm like, that mug is cute, man. I like that mug a lot.
Yeah.
So, and it just kind of snowballed from there, and somehow the American dream can happen if you work hard and make a product that people want, and you're not a complete a-hole.
You can
shoot for the stars, huh?
Isn't it like you know? And again, like I hate to keep bringing up my podcast, but
sure,
you know, it's the same kind of deal with me. You know, like my thought is just try to make something that everybody likes, and everything else will follow. Right.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you said 2003 you had exhibited at Caliente with paintings. I was there. I mean, I've been to every Caliente, so I was there for not 2003. I should say Tiki Caliente number 3.
Yeah, it was probably 2006, maybe.
Okay, 2006. I don't remember when it started, but you know, I wish I had known that. Now, knowing today, you know, it would have been neat to see those paintings because, and I'm sure that I saw them, but I didn't know you then.
Yeah.
I don't think. So it would have been a different thing if I knew you, obviously. I feel more connected, obviously, to people's work when I know who they are, you know, when I know the person who created it, because then...
Oh, totally. I think that's one of the things with...
Yeah, a relationship to it, you know, because they're my buddies, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things, you know... When you're an artist and you make art, and people, you know, they take your art home. When I, you know, back when I used to paint, I'd have a painting in the gallery or in the studio, and people would walk in and they're like, "Oh, when I look at this painting, I totally get it. It means that, you know, like this figure represents that, and this is going on, and these emotions are coming through." And you're like, "No, I just wanted to paint a cool robot," you know. But people lose that connection with it because you dismiss their emotional connection with it, which is their what they bring to the table when they're viewing art. And so you learn early not to say those kinds of things to people because you're diminishing their enjoyment of the art. And but they also when they buy your art, I still get, you know, I've sold paintings, and Shag and I just kind of like talked about it, like, where are our old paintings? Yeah, the Shag store burned down in Palm Springs, and I was like, you know, I saw him at Oasis, and I was like, oh my gosh, so sorry about the shop. And my first thing was, were there original paintings in the shop? Because they're just lost to history once that happens, you know. And he's like, there were no originals lost in the deal. He said he'd lost, when Katrina hit, he had lost a couple of big originals down in New Orleans and stuff. And,
oh, wow.
You know, when you make art, you know, you pour so much yourself into it, and then it just disappears, and you don't even, sometimes you know, with galleries, you don't even know where it goes. So
that's gotta be, I mean, like, don't you ever get connected to your work? I mean.
Oh, sure.
So yeah, when you don't know what ends up, you know, where those things go, you know, that's gotta be kind of disheartening sometimes, right?
It's where, you know, I think some people never sell their art because they can't let go of it. You know what I mean? So it's nice. I think that art becomes a sacred object in other people's houses or other people's lives. Like, I have art that was my father's art that I grew up with, you know, that was from the 60s. Mm-hmm. I have an emotional connection with it because it was my childhood. And then my son grew up with it, and he will get it when I go, you know. So the same thing is true with my art. I was painting robots and scooters and clowns. Some of my best art ever was clown art. But the people buy these paintings, they take them home and they hang them on their walls, and then their children grow up with it, and they go through all their trials and tribulations with it. And it becomes a sacred object in their lives, where it was just a cool tiki painting. For me, it becomes something in their lives. And then when the parents die, the children fight over who gets it. And, you know, it lives on. I always tell people, like, we do so much work. I have several people that work for me. When I hire them on, you know, one of the little speeches I give them is that, you know, there is Ming Dynasty China that is made exactly the way we make our ceramics. That is, you know, 5,000, 20,000 years old.
Wow.
Which means that a tiki mug that we make today, it could theoretically, in the year 7,017, could be in the Orion belt on a spaceship. And somebody was like, this is an Ikumbukum tiki mug, you know, and they can be
That's
here for
crazy.
7,000 years.
That's a thought that I've never thought about.
As an artist,
it's right.
Really kind of cool.
You're right. You're totally right. I mean, this is stuff that could be, you know, there in the early days of Tiki Central, people were talking a lot about finding vintage items in thrift stores and junk stores and that kind of stuff. And there was a guy in Europe that said, you know, it's funny when you guys talk about
vintage,
about vintage, you guys are, you know, and he said specifically Americans, right? Because he's like, you know, you guys go back to maybe the 40s and 50s, 60s, right? You consider 60s vintage. It is, right? They're like
totally.
The stuff from like the Hawaii Kai or the Kahiki or, you know, any of these old palaces,
sure.
You know, it's from the 50s and 60s, maybe 70s at the latest. He's like, you know, our vintage stuff, it goes back to the medieval era. He's like, I could find like a medallion from the medieval era in, you know, in a junk store or in a, and that blew me away. Where I thought, wow, so yeah, that's true antiques right there, true collectibles. Like our stuff is 50 years old, and his stuff is 500. You know, so
it's funny. When I lived in Italy for 4 years when I was in the army, and you know, I've been a junk store, you know, thrift store, and antique guy my whole life. I have collections of tons of things. So you would go to these antique shops, and just like you said, everything was 400 years old. And to find anything that was 50 years old, you just had to go to the junk shop, and they were like, "Yeah, this is just junk." I think Americans I think we're more thinking about reminiscence of our own childhood. My wife loves to see like 70s plastic stuff that was in her house when she was growing up, you know. So our antiques are their vintage, and you know, our historical stuff are their antiques over in Europe, for sure.
Crazy. I know that you have some mugs to make, so I'm going to let you go, but before we go, is there anything that you want to promote?
I have a website, which is ikumbukum.com. It's just our name, EEKUMBOOKUM.com. And my artist name is Mulder142. I do a lot of stuff on Facebook, just like everyone else. And you come and see us at the events. I'm going out to Tiki Week, and I guess Martin Kate is doing a big seminar, and we're going to do a Tiki Mug talk right before Martin goes on. So I'm going to do a little seminar out there for the tiki mug making.
Where's this one?
That's in Texas. It's in Austin, Texas, on September 12th. And just come and see us at the bar. We're always popping into every bar we can find.
Of course. You can't find John Mulder. Just check the bar.
Check the bar. That's awesome.
Well, hey, man, I appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me and be on the podcast. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, man. Not just to talk about your art, but just because I consider you a good friend. And
thanks,
I love having my buddies on the show, right? I like to put a spotlight on all my friends. So Thanks again for that. And for our listeners out there, if you have any questions for John, if you have any comments, you want to leave a shout out, go to our Facebook group page, Inside the Desert Oasis Room, or check us out at Polynesian
Pop. I'm a member.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you.
Right on.
Thanks for the support, John. And I look forward to seeing what you're coming out with next.
Thanks,
and,
bro.
And maybe, you know, hopefully in the near future, I'll get to do a project with you.
Yeah, I'd love that. I'd love to be involved for sure.
Awesome. Well, tell Janet I said hello.
I will.
And we will talk with you soon.
All right. Thanks, Adrian.
All righty. Cheers.
All right. Cheers.